Good evening, everyone, to those here tonight and to those online. For those who don't know me, my name is Dennis Moriarty, and I'm the Group Managing Director of Our Community, an organisation that provides support, training, software and information for Australia's community sector and not-for-profits, and the convener of the Joan Kerner Social Justice Oration. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands that we meet on today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, past and present. This land was never ceded, and while the voice may have gone down, there are still many with hope and fire in their belly to ensure justice prevails. As many in this room and online know, the fight for justice is often a long and disappointing journey, but we will get there. And in line with the rallying words of Joan Kerner herself, etched on the made boardroom at our community house, she said, "Get angry, then get organised." If ever there was a rallying cry, that is it. Most importantly, thank you all so much for being here tonight. For those in the room, it's wonderful to see you all, and for those online, thanks for being there. The oration is not just a one-night affair, though. Technology does have its pluses, and the recorded orations on the Our Community website have received up to 500,000 downloads. So if you feel no one is listening or is interested in the cause for social justice, you are wrong. The speakers and speeches have a long-term legacy, and I thank each one of them for putting so much effort into them. I have a couple of formalities to get through first. First off, I offer the apologies of my chair, Carol Schwartz, who is at a family memorial tonight. I say hello to every one of each of you, as you are VIPs to us, but I also need to recognise some of those that we support, and they provide wisdom to us. Most importantly, looking to our future leaders, we have 15 Year 12 students from Bendigo Secondary College here today. Welcome. Thank you. Adjunct Professor Susan Pascoe, our Community Directors Council Chair and the much-loved inaugural ACNC Commissioner, and now in the new role of Special Advisor to the Pope and Vatican, very important role. Debbie Blakey, CEO of HESTA. Simon Overland, CEO, Burnie City Council. Joe Caddy, Vicar General, Catholic Archdiocese of Melbourne. I think he's acting... Are you allowed to be an acting archbishop? Or whatever an archbishop... They're all acting, are they? Marion Richardson, OAM. Bruce Mildenhall, former member for Footscray and ex-parliamentary secretary to the Premier. Sonia Hood from our Community Directors Council and also the president of the North Melbourne Football Club, to bring it back down. Great to see a president of an AFL football club at a social justice oration, and also one that took out on the leadership role of sacking a footballer after persistent family violence issues. Thank you. We're also missing Cathy Richardson tonight, our Executive Director. Cathy is now based in London, heading up the UK Europe offices of our community. Yes, we have now gone global with our Smarty Grant software. Those of you who have interacted with our community over the years will know how important tonight's presentation is to us. It was the highlight of the Communities in Control Conference for many years, and although we're running things a little differently now, it still remains the highlight of our year, so thank you for being with us. Before we get officially started, a couple of bits of housekeeping. If you're in the room, please turn off your phones. If you're in home, that's okay, you can ring till our heart's content. The recording of tonight's oration will be available online on the Communities in Control website over the next week. For those in the room, we'll be hosting some drinks and canapés afterwards on the right, so please join us for that. Most importantly tonight, we're here to listen to one of the great political leaders in our country. the Honourable Tanya Plibersek, and we're also here to celebrate one of the fiercest champions of social justice I have known, Joan Koerner. Joan, as I'm sure everyone here knows, was Victoria's first female premier and probably our most courageous social justice warrior. She was a dear friend of our community, and I was fortunate enough as a public servant to work with Joan and then later in life to call her a dear friend. Joan fought inequality wherever she saw it. In fact, she fought many times. She was on the front line in the battles for educational equality, gender equality, and environmental justice, and many other justices. Our state, our country, would be far poorer if we hadn't had Joan. Those of you who were lucky enough to meet her would understand that this focus on fairness and equality really came from Joan's deep empathy with people. Joan was incredibly respected throughout her life, and that's never more apparent when I speak to the presenters of the oration each year, who are all honoured to have the opportunity to respect Joan's legacy by offering their views on how to improve our communities, just as she always strived to do. For the past 13 years, I have had the honour of introducing some of Australia's great thinkers to the stage to present this oration, the likes of Julia Gillard, Andrew Denton, Sharon Burrow, Professor Gillian Triggs, Waleed Ali, Craig Foster, and there are many, many more. The highlight, of course, was when Joan herself took the stage in 2012, presenting the oration named after her. This year, we have the honour of welcoming Tanya Plibersek to the eminent list of Australians presenting the oration. Tanya Plibersek is the Minister for the Environment and Water and the Federal Member for Sydney. She was also a good friend of Joan's. Between 2013 and 2019, Tanya was Deputy Leader of the Opposition and Deputy Leader of the Federal Parliamentary Labor Party. That's a task in itself. From 2013 to 2016, Tanya was also Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs and International Development. From 2017 to 2022, Tanya was the Shadow Minister for Education and the Shadow Minister for Women. Tanya served as a cabinet minister in the Gillard and Rudd governments. Tanya was Minister for Health, Minister for Medical Research, Minister for Housing, Minister for Human Services, Minister for Social Inclusion, and Minister for Status of Women. Is there no ministry that you haven't run? Very good one. Scott should have taken that advice. Tanya grew up in the Sutherland Shire of Sydney and is the daughter of migrants from Slovenia. Like many newly arrived migrants, Tanya's parents helped build the country in which they made their new home. Her father worked on the Snowy River hydroelectric scheme in the 1950s. Tanya holds a BA of Communications Honours from the University of Technology, UTS, in Sydney, and a Master of Politics and Public Policy from Macquarie University. Before entering Parliament, Tanya worked in the Domestic Violence Unit at the New South Wales Ministry for the Status and Advancement of Women for Sydney in 1998. She spoke of her conviction that ordinary people working together can achieve positive change. Tanya lives in Sydney with her husband Michael and her three children, Anna, Joseph and Lewis. What a record and achievement that is. As a significantly lapsed, or better still, collapsed Catholic, there were days I would pray that Tanya would be Prime Minister. Obviously, my sins got in the way, and I am glad, as I think what you have done and achieved, you are already above the PM job. I think the obvious next job is the First President of Australia. But until that time, please keep up your passion for social justice, and thank you on behalf of all of us who simply adore the work you do and the way that you do it. Please welcome Tanya Plibersek to deliver the 2024 Joan Koerner Social Justice Oration. Thank you.
you. The introductions like that always make me feel like I'm at my own funeral. Thank you very much, Dennis Moriarty, and thank you to our community for organising this event tonight. It is an incredible honour to be here to celebrate the legacy of Joan Kerner. I want to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on tonight, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present, to any other First Nations people we have in the room with us tonight, or those who are watching from home. I also was going to acknowledge all of the special guests, but Dennis has done such a great job of that that I'm just going to skip that and say all of you welcome, one and all, special guests, all of you. It's great to have you all here tonight. It was the 26th of September 1994, almost 30 years ago, at Labor's National Conference in Hobart, that the Australian Labor Party decided to introduce targets to increase the number of women in Parliament. I remember very clearly the jubilation of that day, a group of us running from the bleachers where we'd been sitting, observing the conference, onto the conference floor after the vote, thrilled at what that meant for the future of our party and for the future of our country. These targets were the work of many, but Joan Kerner was the first among equals when it came to increasing women's representation in Parliament. Joan was a pioneer. She was the first woman Premier of Victoria, and she wanted to support other women, creating a change that would endure long after she had gone. This change would help more women enter politics, breaking through the male-dominated networks that had characterised the ALP. Joan knew targets were good for women, good for the party, and most importantly, good for the country. If women were represented at the decision-making tables, in the Expenditure Review Committee, at the Cabinet table, the material aspects of women's and children's lives across Australia would be improved. We saw evidence of this in the Whitlam government when the then Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam, appointed Elizabeth Reid as the world's first ever advisor on women's affairs to a Prime Minister. It was a groundbreaking move, and look at the policies that followed her appointment in 1973. Free university education, which educated a whole generation of women and changed the trajectory of their families' lives for the generations to follow. No fault divorce. Women's refuges funded for the first time, and a social security system changed forever with the single mother's benefit. No longer would unmarried women feel that they had no choice but to give up their babies for adoption because they couldn't support themselves or their baby. While influential advisors like Elizabeth Reid were pivotal, the role of women was yet to be baked into the political system. Our presence at the decision-making table was far from assured. Joan knew that, and she knew that the way to assure that future was to nail it down via targets. The targets, supported by the then Prime Minister Paul Keating in 1994, prescribed that by 2002, 35% of candidates pre-selected for winnable federal parliamentary seats must be women, whether the Labor Party was in government or in opposition. The response of the then Tasmanian Liberal Premier, Michael Hodgman, was that, and I quote, because I love quoting this, "The mad as a march hare feminists have got the Labor Party firmly by the testicles. The extreme lesbian elements which have infiltrated the ALP are delighted with their success." Well, I'd say all elements of the ALP are delighted with the success of targets for gender equality. For Liberals, targets are a dirty word. The only worse word is quota. And because of their refusal to clear a path for women, they have found themselves to be unelectable in the wilderness. On paper, the Liberals have the same goal as Labor of having 50% female candidates by 2025. You may have noticed that Peter Dutton has stopped talking about this. They are wildly off track, and will clearly fail to meet the benchmark that they set themselves. This term, the Liberals have passed up opportunities to bring women into Parliament, replacing outgoing parliamentarians Scott Morrison, Stuart Robert, Karen Andrews and Maurice Payne with men, and pre-selecting a man for the Dunkley by-election. So the Liberal Party has lost the women that should have been Liberal Party members and candidates to the Teals, and consequently has also lost the seats where most of their donors and members live. In contrast, for Labor, targets have taken us from strength to strength. We've embraced the path that we set at the Labor conference in 1994, and we've taken it further. We weren't satisfied with 35%. In 2012, the first target was replaced with a 40-40-20 target. And in 2015, we moved to a 50% target by 2025. In 2022, for the first time in Australian history, a majority women government was elected federally, beating our own target by 3 years. And now there are 55 women in a Labor caucus of 104 MPs, or 53%. Targets are vital, but as the Liberals demonstrate, on their own, they're not enough. Rule changes that cement the targets must follow, and that's something that Liberals have failed to do. And just as important as targets and rules, women entering politics need resources and they need networks. Hence the creation in 1996 by Joan and a group of other women of Emily's List in Australia. Emily's List was established to support, mentor and fund women candidates. And almost 30 years on, Emily's List is still going strong. Those of you who can see the picture of Joan on the podium can see she's wearing her Emily's List badge. In the three decades that have passed, not only has Labor built a majority women federal government, but also 162 of 332 Labor MPs in state and territory governments, that's 49%, are women. So the point of this work is not so individual women can get half the spoils. The point is that our parliaments and any organisation makes better decisions when the people sitting around the table look more like the whole of our community. So just like in Elizabeth Reid's time, you can see the effects on policy of that more equal representation, and that's what matters. One of the first things the Albanese Labor government did after we won the last election was to legislate for 10 days paid domestic violence leave. We implemented a significant wage rise for aged care workers, around 90% of whom are women. Last week's budget included extra money for more wage rises for aged care workers and early childhood educators. Early in our term, we passed legislation around the reporting and transparency of the gender pay gap, a gap that has fallen to its lowest level on record. And the government has supported wage rises for the minimum wage, which flows on to award-dependent workers, again, most of whom are women. Our fairer tax cuts benefit more women too. Women disproportionately benefit from the changes to give more of the tax cuts to low and middle income earners. More entitlements have been restored to sole parents to support their children into their teens. And in last week's budget, there is money to pay superannuation on Commonwealth paid parental leave so that the carers of small children are not economically disadvantaged down the line in retirement. Katie Gallagher has laid out a detailed, thoughtful plan and a path to gender equality, and Amanda Rishworth and Linda Burney and Justine Elliott have presented a blueprint to end violence against women in a generation. Many of these ideas have been part of our feminist wish list for as long as I can remember. What's changed is the fact that we have ministers at the table to make the case and a whole government willing to back them. We've been working for decades to improve women's economic security and independence and reduce violence against women. And I can't recall a time when a government has made more progress or made a greater financial investment. It's all good stuff. It's hard fought and hard won, and I'm really proud to be part of a government that takes seriously the needs of Australian women and is delivering. And yet, who of us in recent months or the last few years has not felt like we are going backwards for women in some really important areas? Who of us hasn't felt alarm on some level that society might be becoming more sexist and more dangerous for women, not less? When just about every type of crime is declining, except for sexual violence and harassment against women. The events of April 13 at Bondi Junction, Westfield, shocked us all. This is a shopping centre that is just down the road from my electorate. It's somewhere I regularly go, my kids regularly go there, shopping, go to the movies, whatever. When six people were murdered there that Saturday, five of them women, in what appears to be a gendered attack, we felt sick to our stomachs. Pekria Dakia, Ashley Good, Dawn Singleton, Jade Young, Ishun Cheng were murdered, along with heroic security guard Faraz Tahir. Other women killed this year include Molly Ticehurst, Rebecca Young, Hannah Maguire, Chaitanya Swaitha Madagani, Erica Hay, and too many more. We have this terrible roll call of murdered women, murdered allegedly by intimate partners or former partners. This year alone, one every 4 days. 27% of Australian women will experience domestic violence from the age of 15. 27%. One in five will experience sexual assault. There is, quite rightly, outrage at the rates of violence against women in this country. Yet victim survivors share a depressing refrain. The court process is re-traumatising, and even if by some miracle a perpetrator is found guilty under the very high criminal standard, too often sentences don't reflect the seriousness of the crime and the toll the crime takes. We cannot claim to have achieved gender equality while women continue to be unsafe in their homes or on our streets or in our workplaces. As I said, the rates of almost every type of crime are falling. The exception is sexual violence and harassment against women. Why? What's happening? And how do we respond to this? Of course we have made progress, and I think it's really important to acknowledge that progress and to celebrate improvements. Earlier this year we acknowledged 50 years since the opening of the Elsie Women's Refuge in Glebe, and so much has changed since then, and it's really important to acknowledge the hard work of the people that have made that possible. The work of those activists over half a century, and even before, as we were saying earlier, Dennis, and the victim survivor advocates, including Saxon Mullins, Rosie Batty, Grace Tame, Jess Hill, Chanel Kontos, Brittany Higgins, all of them have led to changes in law and in practice. The second national plan on violence against women and their children, launched by Katie Gallagher, Amanda Rishworth and Linda Burney, is a detailed, solid path to making a difference, to reducing rates of gendered violence and to improving responses. The government's also accepted and is implementing the 55 recommendations of Respect at Work, which addresses women's safety in the workplace. The Jenkins report, which examined women's safety in Parliament House, my workplace, has seen our government accept and implement all 28 recommendations, and we're still working on this. We're still going to do more. Our changes to family law once again prioritises the best interests of children. What an important change that is. the Attorney General's review of experiences of sexual assault victims in the legal system will lead to further changes designed to reduce the re-traumatisation of going to court. There's state changes to affirmative consent and to bail laws for domestic violence offenders. Each one of these is a step forward. But I am really worried that all of this work, the work of the women's movement and the family, domestic and sexual violence sectors, as well as our work as governments, has run up against an insidious and powerful countervailing force. It really does often feel like we take two steps forward and get shoved back a step by social media fed and led misogyny. It feels like backlash. I'm sure that some of you have read Susan Faludi's book, Backlash, released in 1991. It showed through meticulous research that gains that were made at that time by women in the workforce, in equal pay, in access to education, were accompanied by a backlash. The more women gained, the more media-driven scare campaigns started appearing, warning that educated women wouldn't be able to find husbands, or that children in daycare were worse off than those with stay-at-home mums. For every step that women took forward, there was something working against progress. But what Susan Faludi couldn't have predicted then, and what is really dawning on us now, is that the internet, especially social media, algorithms and artificial intelligence, is a potentially deadly accelerant of that backlash. It's a facilitator and a distributor of the backlash in these modern times. So what do I mean by this? That the system itself, social media, can push users into misogynistic content even when they're not looking for it. So tonight I want to talk about how social media is helping to drive violence against women and girls, how artificial intelligence has the potential to make things even worse, and how we must urgently start to deal with this new frontier. Right now, there's a generation of young men being targeted by malign influences and malign influencers. They're being targeted by social media algorithms only interested in profit, and we as parents don't know the half of it. How do we know what our kids are watching and consuming on their phones when each person's feed is specifically tailored for them? We've assumed that when our kids are on social media, they're going into a neutral space where they've got some control and choice about what they see. We trust our kids and we trust the values that we've instilled in them. But we really cannot underestimate just how powerful the anti-feminist algorithm is and how the manosphere can radicalise young men. And yet, as parents, if we ask why the social media giants won't help us by insisting on strengthening age assurance or being more responsible with what they feed our kids, we're accused of being censors and Luddites. Now, I'm not given to moral panic. I'm an enthusiastic user of social media, both for professional purposes, getting my political message out and posting photos of quolls and bettongs and bees and flowers. And I do think that most of the time the internet is pretty marvellous, and I'm glad I live in a time that we've got it. There are some marvellous possibilities with AI as well, including better healthcare and the great hope that AI will relieve us of many of the mundane tasks that we do in the future. But we are in this enormous period of change, and whether AI is on balance beneficial is yet to be determined. I think it's hard for many of us even to remember what life was like before social media and smartphones. It's also easy to forget just how recent these things are. The iPhone arrived in 2007, and with it, pretty soon after, social media. In 2009, the like, retweet and share buttons transformed the social networks from more closed systems between friends to something more akin to public broadcasting and distribution channels. The front-facing phone camera in 2010 was the start of the selfie era, and Facebook acquired Instagram in 2012, boosting its popularity, particularly amongst young women. Suddenly, what was fun had darker possibilities. The front-facing cameras and selfies led to a huge focus on beauty and body image. The like and retweet buttons created echo chambers and fueled online toxicity. And the phone itself, always there, always on, meant that you could never escape the judgment of strangers, the notifications, the bullying, the emails from your boss at all hours, and the endless, bottomless feeds. Over the years, we've become aware of the costs, including the damage caused to our ability to focus, damage to our body image and self-esteem due to the popularity and prevalence of picture-based apps like Instagram and Snapchat, and the burnout caused by being always on. And then there is another dark side that has a particularly gendered lens. Too many kids are getting their sex education from online pornography. And today, with smartphones everywhere, kids have got porn in their pockets. Boys are learning how to treat women and girls from watching violent and degrading pornography. And from the social media manosphere, influencers target young boys who want guidance about how to exist in a world without the old rituals and rites of passage. The video games that young boys grow up playing are predominantly designed by men. Women working in gaming have long faced a toxic culture and backlash when they try to make games less stereotypical and include strong female characters. According to reports by the ABC, female video game developers and critics in Australia say they've been threatened with rape and murder as part of vicious disputes around video game design. As for the users of these games, young men who grow up with a sexist portrayal of women in video games, they report stronger support for traditional masculine stereotypes and decreased empathy for female victims. In 2016, study, Italian high school students who played violent and sexist video games reported stronger support of traditionally masculine roles than those who played a neutral game. In addition, the study found those playing the violent and sexist game had decreased empathy for female victims. It's not just video games that are promoting more extreme content. It's pornography. Kids are watching choking and anal sex before they've had their first kiss. 70% of boys have seen pornography before the age of 13. Almost all of them have seen it by 14, almost universally. When they do become sexually active, the images imprinted on their young brains become embodied in real life. Girls are being convinced that uncomfortable, painful, violent, or degrading experiences are a normal part of sex. This is changing the relationship between men and women, girls and boys, and not for the better. The most recent data out of America, the UK and Australia shows that young men are becoming less progressive than their older counterparts. That is, they are less likely to identify as feminists than their older millennial peers. The Survey Centre on American Life found a nearly 20-point gender gap between Gen Z men and women in identifying as feminist. Only 43% of Gen Z men say that they generally think of themselves as feminist, compared to 61% of Gen Z women. The gender gap is more pronounced amongst Gen Z than any other generation. In contrast, according to that same survey, most millennial men identify as feminist. In fact, they claim the label in roughly equal numbers to millennial women. In Australia, similar surveys align with this trend. The 2017 Young Australians' Attitude to Violence Against Women and Gender Equality found that 52% of young men, compared with 37% of young women, believe many, this is what they agreed with, believe many women exaggerate gender inequality. And younger men are more likely than older men to believe that, quote, women prefer men to be in charge of a relationship. What's happening to our younger generation? Why are they so different from the kids that came just a few years earlier? Theories and evidence are starting to emerge. American social scientist Jonathan Haidt, in his new book, The Anxious Generation, examined mental health data for young people and found that even before the pandemic, rates of mental illness and hospital visits for adolescent psychological issues had doubled since 2010. Doubled. His view, between 2010 and 2015, childhood and adolescence got rewired when smartphones became ubiquitous and time spent in face-to-face play or playing outside independently plummeted. The loss of a play-based childhood and its replacement with a phone-based one meant that mental distress among teenagers soared. This theory is not without its critics. Correlation doesn't equal causation, they argue, but something is going on. In Australia, the statistics are also extremely alarming and they mirror the US experience as described in Haidt's book. The National Mental Health Survey in 2022 revealed the annual prevalence of mental ill health in 16 to 24-year-olds had surged from 26% in 2007 to 39% in 2020 to 2022, an unprecedented increase of 50% in just 15 years. The mental health of young women is declining even more rapidly than young men. These rates of mental illness for young people are double the level of the rest of the Australian adult population. Former Australian of the Year and mental health expert, Professor Patrick McGorry, was concerned, saying, if such a dramatic increase in prevalence had occurred in cancer, heart disease, or any other major illness, it would be the catalyst for urgent and decisive action. Of course, the pandemic has played its part, but the statistics were on the rise way before the lockdowns. This, of course, has huge cost implications. The World Economic Forum modelling has revealed that mental illness is the dominant health cause of loss of GDP, with double the impact of cancer. Our own Productivity Commission revealed that in Australia, poor mental health and suicide could have an annual cost to the economy of up to $200 billion. But we want people to flourish. So, of course, we need to make sure that we invest more in mental health care. And in this most recent budget, for example, we're investing $361 million over 4 years to expand the range of free mental health services, including 61 free walk-in Medicare mental health centres. But we're never going to be able to catch up if rates of mental distress continue to rise in the way that they have. And we can't reach our target of ending violence against women in a generation if the next generation of men is being trained by social media to hate and hurt women. Canberra writer Carla Wilshire, who is here with us tonight, Carla, has written a fantastic book, Time to Reboot, Feminism in the Algorithm Age. And I have to say, if you're interested in this topic tonight, this is mandatory reading. Like, I've been interested in this for a while. I learnt so much from this book. Carla writes in chilling detail about how young men and boys have been pushed into more misogynistic content, even when they don't want to engage with it. Carla's work was incredibly eye-opening for me, and I have to say again, really please pick up a copy. Last year, Carla's organisation, the Social Policy Group, conducted research into the attitudes of teenage boys and young men in the context of gaming and social media. One young man who was interviewed described how he was constantly bombarded with content by Andrew Tate, who you all know is a now jailed anti-feminist influencer and sex trafficker. In an attempt to beat the algorithm, this young man spent considerable time trying to alter his feed away from this type of content, but to no avail. So even deliberate, repeated attempts by users to get away from the misogynist content is thwarted. This young man said, it pops up no matter what I do. These social media companies could change the algorithm. They could do it with the adjustment of the code that they're writing. They could do it with the proverbial flick of a switch. So why don't they? Much of social media runs on division and conflict. You just have to look at X. The tweets that are most extreme and negative have the most engagement. More engagement means more profit. So if big tech won't change algorithms and we can't hack our way out of the misogynist feeds, what can we do? Well, we need a safer online environment for kids. We should all be working to keep young people safer online. It's no longer a choice. We have to push back. The government set up a parliamentary inquiry into the influence and impacts of social media on Australian society. My colleague Michelle Rowland has brought forward a review of the Online Safety Act to keep pace with emerging harms. She's trialling age assurance technologies now, and she's quadrupled funding to the eSafety Commissioner, who has incidentally fantastic resources for parents who want to better understand their kids' online environment. As parents, we've been so vigilant on child safety, but I really don't think we've been vigilant enough when it comes to social media. We teach our kids to swim when they can barely walk. We've got great safety standards for car seats and cots and button batteries because we want to protect our kids from physical risks. We vaccinate, we teach our kids the right way to blow their nose and wash their hands, all of that stuff. But when we give a child the use of an iPad or cave into their demand to get a phone or join social media, we don't have the equivalent guardrails. You wouldn't think of putting in a pool today without putting in a pool fence. Across many apps, there are laughable barriers. Do you have parental permission? Check. Are you over 18? Check. And the kids have to tick a box and then they're off and away. They can watch a beheading. They can watch a murder. They can watch porn, plenty of it. They can watch Andrew Tate or Jordan Peterson. They can watch hundreds and hundreds of hours of beauty tutorials or anorexia tips. They can watch anything and everything all of the time. But I really think that maybe I'm not the only one stopping to pause and ask, should I have pushed back more against the absolute incursion of the internet and particularly social media into our lives? Should I have pushed back harder on my own kids' use of social media? And is it too late to push back now? My kids are 13, 19 and 23, and oh, they love it when I talk about them in public. Not really. But I have lately found myself wondering if I should have restricted their social media use until they turned 16. And in fact, I know I'm not the only one. The front pages of last weekend's News Corp papers were asking the same question. Should we wait until our kids are 14 or 15 or 16? Before giving them access to social media? I can tell you it would be much easier as a parent if we broadly agreed on the right age for children to engage with social media. No more kids telling you that you're ruining their lives and wrecking their friendships because they're the only ones not allowed to use Snapchat. Increasingly, the neuroscience is telling us that children's developing brains are not adequately equipped for virtual life. We need to get them settled into actual life before we even start to think about introducing them to the virtual world. There is something really sinister in the fact that the people who invented and turbocharged these systems, the coders and the venture capitalists, are men who, as they grew up and had families of their own, banned their children from using the very tools that they created. Steve Jobs, Jonathan Ive designed some of the world's most desirable tech, but imposed strict limits on their own children using it. In Silicon Valley, tech execs send their children to Montessori schools, where the products they designed are banned. One popular school in Silicon Valley even restricts tech to the extent that students predominantly use pen and paper. The social media giants know that they are deliberately reprogramming our kids. Like big tobacco companies or gaming companies, they know a lifetime of profits depends on consumers getting hooked while they're young. It's not hard to imagine a future where the elites of society will be the ones that are not addicted to tech. They will have the luxury of switching off. They won't have to constantly hustle for likes or retweets. They'll have a better relationship with their body image, with nature. They'll be more socially confident. They'll have more lasting relationships in the real world. And what will happen to more disadvantaged people in society? The kids that are addicted to their phones, reliant on them for work and play, that have their reward system and dopamine drive hacked for likes and notifications. You may think that the horse has bolted, that once your kids have a phone, you will never prize it out of their sticky little hands. But I don't think it's too late to start questioning our relationship with social media. The best time to do that would have been 2007, when we were marvelling at that first hunk of metal and glass, the smartphone that could seemingly do everything. The next best time to do it is now. You see, we are in this very particular hinge moment in history, when we are in the last moments before we have another huge shift with the mainstreaming of AI in our lives. If parents don't know the half of it now, AI will be even harder for us to cope with and comprehend. Very soon, AI will have crashed through and transformed society in ways that most of us don't yet understand. We must seriously consider pushing back against some of the more dangerous elements of AI in a way that we didn't push back in 2007. We can't allow open slather in AI as we did with social media, because the harms are already becoming apparent. Take the deep fake porn apps. You feed a photo of a real person into the app. It then spits out an ultra-realistic pornographic or nude picture of that person. Funnily enough, some of the most popular apps don't work on male bodies, just girls and women. This is a global problem. Last year, Miriam Al-Adlib's 14-year-old daughter showed her deep fake pornographic image of herself, showed it to her mother. It had been doing the rounds of her school in Spain. The mother says, "The image is completely realistic. If I didn't know my daughter's body, I would have thought that image was real," Miriam told the Guardian newspaper. It was just one of dozens of nude images of schoolgirls in this Spanish town that had been generated by AI and which had been circulating in the community for weeks in a WhatsApp group set up by other school children. Trying to shut the app down was almost impossible for parents and authorities, with journalists eventually tracing the company responsible to a headquarters in Belarus and Russia via businesses registered in Europe and a front company in London. These apps and fake images are being used to bully, harass, and cause immense distress to young girls who are pornified by their classmates. And the shonky shop fronts that some of these companies set up around the world make them next to impossible to police or regulate. In Australia, this deepfake technology is already being used to torment children. Parents interviewed by News Corp papers tell horror stories about their children taking their own lives after being bullied and threatened by such fake images. There are so many shocking stories, including that of Tilly Rosewarne from Bathurst, who was bullied from grade 5 onwards but found it escalated when one kid faked a porn photo of her and put it on Snapchat. Tilly suicided. Carla Wilshire, in her book, calls it an epidemic of non-consent. Bullying follows these kids home from school via social media and their phones. They can never escape, and it becomes a million times more toxic and powerful when combined with deep fake porn apps. This stuff matters in the real world. What's happening virtually impacts what's happening in our homes and schools. The government is acting. We'll introduce legislation to ban the creation and non-consensual distribution of deep fake pornography. These reforms will make clear that those who seek to abuse or degrade women through doxing or deep fakes or by abusing their privacy online will be subject to serious criminal penalties. In the most recent budget, we also funded a rapid review of research into perpetrators that we expect will cover their use of social media and technology. Researchers in the area of domestic violence and sexual violence, Jess Hill and Michael Salter, are explicit about the connection between porn and rates of violence against women. Professor Salter said last month, "The technology sector is profiting from services and products that cause mass social harm, including violence against women and children." The most recent research shows that pornography-related searches and downloads range between 10 and 20% of overall internet traffic. While research on the algorithm on porn sites is just beginning, what is clear from studies is that people are being shown and recommended new and more extreme forms of pornography compared to what they searched for or what they expressed a desire for. So you can see that I am starting to believe that this era, the last 20 years or so, will be looked back on by future generations with some dismay. Did we really give tiny children a portal into a world we couldn't see, where forces we couldn't control could undo the work of so much of history's recent progress? Just like we now think with horror of children sent to work in factories at age 12 or letting 14-year-old kids smoke. No guardrails, the worst instincts of humanity, the black mirror, allowed to flourish. Young developing brains rewired after prolonged exposure to social media. The thing social media promised, connection, it actually stole. The young generation that grew up online, is it any surprise that they are the loneliest, the most anxious, and the most depressed generation in history? We need each other. 500 Facebook friends do not come near one really good friend in real life who will hug us when we're down. So how do we fix this? There aren't any easy answers. But we can take steps which might together help improve the situation. We need to be as inventive and creative in our solutions as the tech itself. And this should include challenging algorithms that push harmful and misogynistic content. We can be more conscious and more vigilant to the threats of emerging technology, particularly AI. We accepted the last big tech revolution almost without question. But we can start to question things now. After all, it's our mental health and it's our kids' mental health. We can ask the politicians to do what we can. My colleagues, Michelle Rowland and Ed Husic, are doing fantastic work in this area. But governments face challenges too. For example, when the company is in a different jurisdiction, like X, they become more difficult to regulate, as we saw with the explicit and upsetting Sydney Church stabbing video being available on the platform. There is the possibility of watermarking AI-generated content so people can tell the difference between real and fake content. We can start to think differently and creatively about how regulation might work. We have been more prepared than other countries to step in and regulate tech giants. 3 years ago, the previous federal government did a deal with the big tech companies to pay journalists for their work. And while We're now reliving this struggle as Facebook once again threatens to ban news if they're required to spend money to contribute to the cost of creating news content. We have to keep pushing back. These companies seem to think they are completely outside the law. This is a conundrum for all societies. How do we protect free speech without promoting hate speech? Silicon Valley was built on a deliberately libertarian ethos, but most Australians would agree that protecting children from harm is not government oppression. Then there's personal responsibility. We can control our tech diet. Just like we choose what we eat, we can monitor what we feed ourselves and what we feed our children. As I said in the wake of the Bondi stabbing, you can turn it off. Just turn it off. Of course, I know it's hard when tech companies invest so much to get our kids hooked, but you can see movements across the world are starting to spring up, including in Australia, aimed at bringing older notions of childhood back. Less time on your phone, more freedom to explore and take risks in the outside world. It's good for kids' brains and bodies to explore in this way, and both the federal government and the states are looking at how we can support this with school phone bans and social media age restrictions I already mentioned. Finally, I want to say we're really lucky to have a group of young people here today. So much of this will be up to you. You will be the leaders in your generation. You're here because you care about social justice. One of the greatest offences against social justice in this country is that so many women are so unsafe in their homes, in their workplaces, on the street. So much of the future of how this is managed will come down to your generation and the choices you make. You understand it better than I do. You understand it better than most of the people in this room. The steps you take will be critical to whether we have gender equality in the future or whether we continue to go backwards. We're beginning to learn what the tech giants always knew. Too much of the virtual stuff is bad for us, and it's definitely bad for our kids. We can become more conscious users of tech, aware of the unseen algorithm and where we're directed on social media. We can push back. We can reclaim our time and our brains and our sense of safety. And we can reclaim childhood for our kids who rely on us to help them navigate all the wonders and the perils of growing up. Thank you.
When we started 25 years ago, our community, we always wanted to start with big thinking ahead. And I don't think you could ever have got a better speech than to think big thinking there, the future and what we do now. I think I don't want to create a competition between previous speakers, but that was one of the most profound speeches I've heard in a long, long time. Thank you on behalf of all of us, and keep up your amazing work. And as Tanya said, the future is in your hands. So congratulations for coming. Not yet, yes. Thank you all for joining us. As I said, it's profound. As a company that does think ahead, our Chief Technology Officer, Sarah Barker, is a female. We were thinking a lot more ahead than many of these companies. Thank you all for joining us, and please have a drink. And for those online, and for those that are here as well, this speech will be available online. It's not something I sat there and I thought, my God, that is so profound. I need to think about that more and more. And I think all of us need to digest that and take that in. And I thank you for that absolute wisdom. Thank you for your generosity too.